Guess who's back? Back again. The Extra Movie Butter Boys are back. Tell the Furmans. Welcome back to the Extra Movie Butter Podcast.
That was fucking brutal.
So happy I thought of that earlier today. This week, of course, we will be discussing Dune 2. We have an amazing guest lined up today. The one and only Andrew Gordon will be our guest for the Dune 2 review. But before we get there, of course, I need to introduce my co-hosts, the one and only Benny Hamlin and JT, both of you admiring my singing. I know you're so happy I included that to kick us off. How are you guys tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. I'll give you my only rap I ever remember writing. It was, I'm crazy like Swayze. You could call me Patrick. Three hit movies in a row. That's what they call a hat trick. That's all I got, but it stuck with me.
We are going to be able to retire off of this year's Christmas album, boys.
Oh my god, we should do a calendar every year. Extra Movie Boys. I'll recreate the Nicole Kidman intro. The theater that she shot that in is about 20 minutes from my house. We've been there. I've been in that theater. It's awesome.
Yeah, we should recreate that. That'd be amazing. Well, boys, as always, we are going to be discussing the box office and a little bit of movie news. In our segment number two, Benny is not a huge fan of Denis Villeneuve, so we're not going to do Denis Villeneuve rankings, even though I may have put a couple together, just saying. We will be discussing movies that involve rebel fighters. And then, of course, our third segment will be the Dune 2 non-spoiler and then spoiler with our guest, Andrew Gordon. So to kick it off, boys, let me throw down some box office numbers for you. I think nobody on this panel surprise, Dune Part 2 led the box office $82 million. So before I go to the rest of the numbers, who had $80 million as their guest last week?
JTE nailed that exact.
I think I said like between 80 and 85. Maybe I said like, I think I might have said 83 million. I'll have to go back to the tape, but that's about where I was at.
Well, you nailed it, pal. $82 million this opening weekend. Coming in at number two, Bob Marley, One Love, with $7.4 million. Pretty big contrast between those two. Number three, Ordinary Angels, $3.7 million. Number four, The Chosen, Season 4, Episodes 7 and 8, $3.2 million at Fathom Events. Madam Web coming in at number five with $3.1 million, a total of $40 million domestic. We'll have a little chat about that later. Migration, still doing well, $2.5 million. Demon Slayer, $2.7 million coming in at number seven. Wonka, another 1.7 on the pile. Timothy Chalamet, all of a sudden a box office draw. Number nine, Argyle, $1.3 million. $43 million for Matthew Vaughn on that one. That's a loss. And The Beekeeper, still protecting the hive, in at number 10 with $1.1 million. Gents, I'm going to leave it up to you to decide which of you two is going to go first. But what does the box office numbers tell you?
JTE got it right. He should get to go first.
There it is.
Silence! I was using my Dune powers. Yeah, I mean, listen, I think a lot of people were just starving for a big summer-type blockbuster movie, even though Dune 2 is a little bit more than that. But it does have the big spectacle. I would love to see what the IMAX numbers on this were, because I feel like they're really pushing hard for the IMAX and Dolby screens, because this is a movie that really does feel like it needs to be experienced in the theater, whether you like it or not. Even if you don't like the movie, I don't know how you don't walk out of the theater at least being impressed by the just pure sound design, the sweeping shots, just the production alone is worth a ticket. It's not like one of these movies where you're like, oh man, that movie costs $200 million. It looks like it costs $50 million. Every dollar's on the screen, if not more.
$32.2 million of the $82 million this weekend was from IMAX numbers.
Wow, that sounds high, but this is the movie that deserves it. So I think, you know, this is a big step up from the first one. I think the first opened around 50, if I'm correct. I'm not 100% sure on that. But here's the thing. That went day and date with HBO Max. So a lot of people, we were just coming out of COVID. A lot of people that I know and a lot of friends and family of mine know did not go out in the theater to see it. They watched it at home. I made my way to the IMAX theater to see it because I was in LA. And always given the option for a movie like this, I'm going to see it on the biggest screen possible. But yeah, it was a great screening. I was lucky enough to see the movie about a week early. So it's probably a little bit fresh in your guys' minds than it is mine, because I saw it almost 2 weeks ago. But I probably will go see this at least one more time in theaters. I saw it in IMAX. I think next time I go see it, it'll be Dolby Theater, because I hear Dolby has the sound design. I think, well, IMAX is a bigger screen. Dolby theaters, I think, have better sound. So I want to see it with a better sound now that I've seen it with a big screen. So yeah, that's what I got to say about Dune. The only thing I'll say about is the Hilary Swank movie. What's that movie called?
Ordinary Angels.
Ordinary Angels. Not a movie I was going to go see anytime soon. But I'm just glad to see Hilary Swank being back in theaters. This woman has won 2 Oscars. She's never given a bad performance, really, in my opinion. I mean, yeah, she's straddled with the next Karate Kid, but who's not going to take that job? but for someone who's won 2 Oscars, I feel like she's not getting enough opportunities to like really show what she's made of. And I wish she would get more work. So I'm hoping maybe this will kickstart her, maybe not a comeback, but like a rejuvenation of her career.
So the first Dune opened with $41 million. So this movie literally doubled.
Double, yeah.
From what the first movie did. Benny, how about you? What does this box office numbers tell you, pal?
It tells me that I was really off last week. I managed to miss the under, the over, and the middle on Dune 2. So again, Denis Villeneuve confounds me at every turn. Even my box office sense was off. This is a weird box office for me, because it just feels like I was wrong about everything in the entire box office. Like the Bob Marley movie, I didn't think that that was going to do anything, and it keeps hanging in there and making money. It's made way more than I thought it would at all. Was completely wrong about that. You know, never heard of the Angels with Hilary Swank movie. And I don't know why Hilary Swank was banished, but she does like low budget straight to streaming movies now, and that's her zone. She's like in that Nicolas Cage from 8-9 years ago zone, locked in there. But so I don't know, it's just like a bunch of hangovers and leftover movies from January and February out there feeding on the scraps. And you know, there was finally something for people to go see, for better or worse, and we'll get into that in round 3.
Dune's success, I mean, I agree with what JT said. I mean, it just shows that people are clamoring for a big box office movie. And look, 2024 so far has really not had anything worth like going, wow, that's a good movie. We finally got a big box office movie. It was a good movie. It was anticipated. I mean, look, whether you like the first Dune or you don't like the first Dune, just the trailers for this movie amped this movie up big time. I got excited for this movie just watching trailers for it. And I enjoy the first Dune movie. I think if you cut down 30 minutes off of that movie, it's great. But just watching the trailers for this, I was like, oh man, things are going to get crazier. And yeah, we'll save the review for Dune 2 for the third segment, but I agree 100% with what JTE said. I think that people are just wanting to be able to go back into the box office, and this kind of proves it. I mean, these, the type of crowds that were at movie theaters, like I so far this year, this was the most packed movie theater I've seen. And it felt a little bit like Barbenheimer type atmosphere in the theater again, a little bit of like excitement for people walking in, like as I'm standing in line to get like a sparkling water before the movie, like the people behind me are like, oh my God, you know, do you think that like they're going to show this in the movie, or they're going to show this, or they're going to show this? So I haven't had that kind of atmosphere in a while. So it was nice to be able to have that movie going experience again. I do think Bob Marley, One Love, is a success. The budget for that movie was only $50 million. The movie's made $82 million domestic. I think the movie has mixed reviews, but I think that they were smart with how they released it and when they released it. Because they released it in a very dead zone in the box office, and it's crushed. So I'm glad to see that. And yeah, of course, Migration and Wonka, I say it every week. It's nice to see those movies doing well, because those were movies I enjoyed. But all in all, no surprises. I think credit goes where credit is due to JTE for calling out the I think I went really low for Dune. Benny, you did a lower and a upper, and JT, you nailed it, pal. So I'm glad to see. I enjoyed the movie. We'll talk more about that in the third segment. But yeah, I do want to celebrate Dune's victory this weekend. There's not much.
I did
going
co-host
for a couple of weeks.
I did co-host a show called Box Office Breakdown with the great and one and only, you know, Bobby Finstock and Sarah Stratton. So got a little bit of that Box Office Breakdown juice left in me.
well done, pal. So a little bit of movie news. Not much this week, but there were a couple of stories I figured we should tackle. And one of them being the Naked Gun movie. We've talked about this movie probably three or four times at this point in time. Well, they finally have a director, and thank heavens it is not Seth MacFarlane. Akiva Schaffer has been tapped to direct the new Naked Gun movie starring Liam Neeson as Detective Frank Drebin. If you're unfamiliar with Akiva Schaffer, he's part of the Lonely Island group. He directed the movie Hot Rod, the movie The Watch. I love The Watch. My brother and I quote that shit all the time. Pop Star, Never Stop Parping, and recently the Chippendales Rescue Ranger movie. And honestly, these are all fun comedic movies. You guys were gushing over the Rescue Rangers movie. I've not watched it. Is it worth watching?
Yes, it is.
Oh, yeah, it's hilarious. Like, really smart comedy, especially if you grew up in the 80s and 90s. There's cameos from all these great, like, anime. It feels like a modern day Roger Rabbit in a lot of ways, but it's a detective story like Chinatown. It's great.
It was one of the most surprising movies of the pandemic, to be honest. I really liked it a lot.
Okay. I'm going to put that on my must watch list then. So, gents, hearing that it is not Seth MacFarlane, that was our big concern. It's Akiva Schaffer now directing the Naked Gun remake with Liam Neeson. Benny, does this change your excitement for this movie?
It definitely amps it up, because I'll be honest, like, I would rather them dig up John Ford's corpse and have him direct the Naked Gun than watch a Seth MacFarlane Naked Gun. So the fact that it is anyone other than him, like, triples my excitement for this movie. Because Liam Neeson, like we've said the other times, he's a great choice to redo Frank Drebin, but, you know, you can only do so much to overcome Seth MacFarlane.
How about you, JT? Are you excited now for this?
Yeah, I loved Chip and Dale. I was lucky enough to see it actually on the Disney lot. I was able to get a screening for it. Yeah, through Collider, and they had a Q&A with the director afterwards. And I went to Chip and Dale thinking, oh, this could be fun, and I loved it. It was one of my favorite films that year. So, and Pop Star Never Stopping, whatever it's called, is hilarious. I quote it to this day. It's one of those movies that just gets better with time. And I love Lonely Island overall. I like that group. I like everything they're involved in. So I think Chip and Dale, it's funny because you would think all those other movies are kind of ridiculous and over the top. But Chip and Dale is what really kind of puts me, makes me more excited, because what he did with that property and how good the humor is in that film, I could see, there's moments where I could totally see this guy do a Naked Gun film. So I'm on board, can't wait. And I think Liam Neeson is like perfect casting.
Yeah, I'm way excited about this now. We just were talking before the show, so this is just fresh news for me literally within the last couple of minutes. And now I'm excited for this movie. I agree 100% with everything that you guys said. Like, I have enjoyed Akiva Schaffer's past movies. I mentioned The Watch. I really like Hot Rod. That is another one that I quote all the time. So I think he's got a good idea for comedy, and I think he might pay a little more tribute to kind of these spoof movies from, you know, the 80s and 90s. And so I'm excited for it. We all agree, like, Liam Neeson is a great Frank Drebin in this role. So I'm curious to see, like, who some of the cast around Liam Neeson will be. There's Norberg. You can always, like, I'm curious if they're going to, like, go with another professional athlete. Marshawn Lynch comes
to mind.
It's
got to be Marshawn Lynch, right?
Absolutely. So, yeah, now I'm excited. Now I can sit back and go, like, okay, I'm excited for this movie. Who can we fan cast? Like, let's have some fun with it. I know Seth MacFarlane is going to be writing this movie, or at least have a hand in executive producing. So there may be some stuff that doesn't necessarily work for me, but look, as long as he's not directing it, I think I have faith in Akiva Schaffer to give us a good, like, modern day spoof of these old school 80s and 90s spoofs. So yeah, we're all for it. I like it. The Extra Movie Butter Boys approve. Hollywood, you can proceed. Up next, Superman Legacy. Just titled Superman now. So the new James Gunn directed Superman movie decided to change his title from Superman Legacy to just Superman. I realize, folks, that this isn't hard-hitting movie news. It's a slow week for movie news, all right? Dune dominated. There's your update for the movie news. But, gentlemen, your thoughts on it no longer being titled Superman Legacy?
I'm a big Superman fan, so I'll just jump in here and say I kind of like the Superman Legacy title because, in a way, if you look at the cast for this movie, there are so many characters outside of Superman. In some ways, it feels like they're not just introducing a new Superman, they're introducing the new DC universe. I mean, we got a Green Lantern here. We got several villains. So for me, I kind of thought the Superman Legacy makes sense. But at the end of the day, the first Batman with Michael Keaton was just called Batman. This is just called Superman. I mean, Henry Cavill never really got to be in just a Superman movie. Man of Steel, then he had Batman v Superman. Or was it Superman v Batman? I don't even remember what it was.
It was Batman versus Superman.
He didn't even get the front title in that movie. So let's just have a good old classic Superman film. And yeah, I'm really curious if they're going to use any of the John Williams score. I saw Christian Harloff even tweeted at James Gunn asking him, are you playing? Because I'm curious. I'm real curious about the tone because Superman Returns felt like it basically was a sequel to the first two Richard Donner Superman films, and it wore that on its sleeve. Everything looked like it was, even though it was modern day, it looked like it was like the 1950s at times or the 70s. The Man of Steel just course corrected and went super Zack Snyder, gritty, dark, very like graphic novel looking. So I am very curious to see where the tone and the look of this movie takes its inspiration from. Because that's just a big question mark. Because once I get a better idea of that, I'll have a better idea of what James Gunn is trying to do with this character.
I think psychologically it makes sense because Superman Legacy, it sounds like the title of a sequel. And they need to make it clear to everyone this has nothing to do with all the DC movies beforehand. And sometimes, like, I don't think everyone on Earth pays super attention to movie news. You know, if you're out here in flyover country and you're going to the movies two times a year, you don't pay attention to that kind of thing. And so making it clear that this is a new Superman and not giving it a sequel's title, I think is a good idea. I think it's going to end up being a bright, fluffy tone. I don't really know why I think that, but that's fine for Superman.
Yeah, I have a hunch that this is going to be very light Superman. James Gunn's kind of taken to the DC world with the Suicide Squad. The Suicide Squad was very aggressive. It was very bloody, was very violent. You know, it had his humor peppered in there, and it didn't necessarily work. But you look like a property like Guardians of the Galaxy. And James Gunn loves his obscure comic book characters. So, like, the Green Lantern we're getting is not everyone knows Hal Jordan. It's not going to be Hal Jordan. It's the first Green Lantern 3 before Hal or something like that. So we're going to get a lot of obscure characters. I expect this to be very bright. I expect the comedy to be very heavy. And honestly, I don't care what it's called. The Legacy, yes, I agree 100% with what you said, Benny. Like, the Legacy did make it sound like we would know this Superman from past iterations. Just keeping it Superman, that's perfect. Because it does kind of, okay, this is a new Superman. It's not Henry Cavill coming back. It's not obviously not going to be Christopher Reeve coming back into this role. So I'm fine with this. I doubt Brandon Routh will be coming back in this movie in any capacity. But Superman Legacy did make it seem like we already knew this character and the characters that he was going to introduce. Keeping it simple with just Superman, okay, that's all they need to know. Everyone in the world knows who Superman is. Everyone knows the symbol. So now it just really comes down to James Gunn, who gives a shit what you call it. Just show us what your Superman is about. I think that's my takeaway from the name change.
By the way, shout out. Apparently they're going to be filming part of this movie like 50 minutes away from my house is where that Justice League stuff is going to be shot.
Nice.
Excited about
what?
That.
Hey, if they're doing extras, if they call for extras, you got to go. I want to see you on that big screen in the background. Like, oh my God, Superman.
I want you to be wearing the Benny and Moose Save America superhero outfit. I've got a t-shirt that shows it. So our last little bit of movie news here is Dakota Johnson spoke very candidly about the criticisms of Madam Web, and throughout like the whole press junket, she's really kind of not really taking this movie serious, not really promoted it like a professional. And so her comments really on the negative response of Madam Web was just very bluntly. She says, "I can't say that I don't understand." Obviously this was a movie. I think probably halfway through filming, she said, "You know what? This movie is going to be terrible. We've bashed Madam Web to death at this point in time. I think it's time for Dakota Johnson to do the same." She didn't enjoy it. She fired all of her representation after this movie came out. She's trying to start fresh. I get it. Like, listen, she's very candid person. Like, she's quirky in that way. If you've watched in her interviews, she's very honest. She's very blunt with how she delivers things. She did not enjoy this. She did not like the finished product. She, frankly, at the end of this movie, did not care. And you could tell in the acting performance, but obviously you can tell in the final product of this movie. So again, if she wasn't happy to be part of this, why are you going to put on a straight face? I understand that there is a play ball kid because you got paid to do this movie and at least try to put on a straight face. So there is the professionalism side of things. I think she's past it with this movie. I doubt she'll ever do a movie for Sony again. I think her time and her resume have been shredded at Sony, so she'll never, ever do another movie again. But I do worry a little bit that that might tarnish her a bit in some of directors' eyes. For being a little bit blunt, may tarnish her possibilities to get more acting gigs from other studios, because sometimes studios just need you to play ball. We've talked about directors that a lot of studios will bring in that go, "Hey, we have this script. We just need you to direct the damn thing." And they just come in, they play ball. They don't put a spin on it. They directed the movie as is. And so I'm a little curious to see what ends up happening with Dakota Johnson. I mean, she's not a household name. Certainly Madam Web didn't make her that either. But she's also, she's been in a lot of projects. She's a decent enough actress. So I'm curious to see where these go. But yeah, I'm not offended by her saying that. And I don't think she'll ever work for Sony again. That's my take on that. How about you, JT?
Yeah, you know, even Sydney Sweeney, who hosted SNL this week, took a shot at Madam Web. So I think everybody involved with that, I basically come to the conclusion what ended up coming out is not what they signed on for. And I don't think she'll really have trouble with other directors, because I think any director who watches Madam Web will be like, "Oh, snap, you were just stuck in a horrible situation." It probably will hurt her relationship maybe with Sony, but she'll be fine. The director of Past Lives has already attached her to her next project, and that's nice. Coming off a Best Picture nomination. Also, Sony should thank Dakota Johnson, because her whole press tour put more attention on this movie than if she just played game and went and did what she was supposed to do. It probably helped the box office that she was being the way she was, because people were like, "Holy crap, she's checked out. We got to go see this movie. It has to be really bad." I mean, so at the end of the day, I think she's going to come out just fine.
Yeah, I think part of the interview was just her saying that, okay, superhero movies are not going to be her bag. This was a one and done thing. And that's fine. You know, some people aren't built to do that. Some people are built to do other things. Maybe she can go back to the 50 Shades universe or whatever it is that was working for her. But I don't know. I think, like, on the press tour, like, you should say whatever it is they ask you to say. But, like, once the movie comes out, like, you're not going to affect its success anymore at this point. So what she's saying now, I don't think matters one bit. She's not going to cost Madam Web anything. Now, I think maybe on the press tour, you could have been a little more professional. But, like I said, anything they say now is not going to – it can only help at this point. That, you know, controversy may make a few more dollars now at this point. But other than that, I don't think it matters much.
I did see the Sydney Sweeney bash of the Madam Web thing too on Saturday Night Live. That was actually kind of funny. The whole her whole opening monologue and shtick with Glenn Powell was funny too. So Well, anyhow, that is our movie news. That is our box office breakup. We are going to take a little break, folks. You'll hear from our sponsors. And then up next, we're going to talk a little bit of Denisville news, because I put together the rankings before I put together my favorite movies with a rebellion. So stay tuned.
The Stargate. It will take you 1 million light years from home, but will it ever bring you back? What a rush. The critics are calling Stargate the most amazing film of the year. A cosmic joyride, part Star Wars, part Close Encounters, part Indiana Jones. All fun. No! A glorious, rip-roaring, time-traveling adventure. Stargate, rated PG-13, starts Friday.
Ruthless invaders, a defenseless planet, and a daring band of space adventurers fighting to save it. Battle beyond the stars. A battle that ends in a desperate gamble.
They'll be able to board us.
It won't make any difference.
Richard Thomas, George Pappard, Robert Vaughn, John Saxon. Battle beyond the stars. Rated PG. Starts Friday.
Welcome back, and let's talk our favorite Denis Villeneuve movies before we get into our favorite movies with the Rebellion. I'm going to pass it to Benny first because I feel like he's going to be short with his segment. But Benny, is there any Denis Villeneuve movies that you enjoy?
Enjoy is a very strong word, like an immensely strong word. Like, so I will say on my rewatch of Dune 1 that it got up to okay. Like, I didn't mind watching it a second time, but I'm not like, I can't wait to go watch that bad boy a third time, you know? Arrival, I think that may have well have been written with crayon. It was like a child wrote that movie who found their dad's philosophy book. Awful. Sicario, in three attempts, I've yet to be able to ever finish the movie. It's just not for me. I've not seen Blade Runner or Incendies, and then the other one is Prisoners, or I'm mixing them up.
No, you got Prisoners and Enemy.
Okay. Though I've not seen Enemy. Prisoners, I do not really remember. I have seen it, but it doesn't stand out. It's like all of his movies. They're very lovely, very boring. And so those are my rankings. Dune is okay. The rest of them are awful that I've seen.
Fair enough. JT, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I like all his films to varying degrees. The only one of his I couldn't really connect with was the Gyllenhaal film Enemy.
Yep.
And I was not a huge fan of Prisoners. I don't think it's bad. I just think it's too long. And there are certain things in it, choices that he made that I didn't enjoy, which I can't really get into because I don't want to get spoilers. But so Prisoners, not a bad movie, but I know people who love that movie, and I'm just not there. Same way I was with Dune. I didn't love the first Dune, and a lot of people love that movie. But I do love Sicario. I think Sicario might be my favorite film of his. I think Del Toro's amazing. I think Emily Blunt, Josh Brolin, beautifully shot movie by Roger Deakins, badass Benicio Del Toro performance. There's several scenes in that movie that I could just watch that one scene and I'd be like, that's amazing. And I am a fan of Blade Runner 2049. I think it's as good as of a sequel you could do to one of the greatest sci-fi movies ever made. I don't think it's better than the original Blade Runner, but I do understand some people who might have an easier time watching it because it is a much more modern film and it's a beautiful film. And once again, shot by Roger Deakins. So Sicario and Blade Runner are up there for me. I think Rival's really good. Also, I think Incendiaries, how do you pronounce it?
Incendies, I think.
Incendies, there you go. Yeah. That is a really well done film, but a very hard watch. I saw it once, and I don't know if I'll ever want to go back and watch it again because it was a very hard movie to watch. It's very, very troubling at times, especially the third act, which if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. But overall, I think he's a really, you know, interesting director. And if you make Blade Runner, Sicario, I think those movies are pretty amazing. So those are my two favorites.
Blade Runner 2049 is, I think, my favorite of his. I very much enjoyed it. So the first Blade Runner movie, I'm not as gaga about as Others, like, I think that there's like a director's edition that is probably the best cut of that movie, or the director's cut. I don't know. There's like eight different variations of Blade Runner, but I actually thought Blade Runner 2049 was amazing. And then, like, you have a very like subdued performance from Ryan Gosling in that. But then, like, there are scenes in that movie where Harrison Ford just kills it, like kills it. Like, maybe some of the best acting Harrison Ford, I think, has ever done. So I very much enjoy Blade Runner. I think it's a great movie to just put a pin in that. Like, I guess you can call it a franchise since there's a second one. I enjoy Arrival a lot. Dune Part 2 is probably my second favorite. Sicario is amazing. I agree 100% with you, JT. I think Benicio del Toro's just brutal characterization of this man who is just getting revenge on this drug dealer is incredible. He's just ruthless, but you realize, like, that's the world that he's, you know, chosen to fuck around in. So I like Sicario. I've not seen Enemy with Gyllenhaal. I've heard a lot of mixed things about that one. I think Villeneuve has like a visual display, but also I think his movies are way too long. Every one of them is way too long. Every one of them, I feel like you could cut down like 25 to like 45 minutes and they would be just perfect. I enjoy the first Dune a lot. But again, I said it earlier, if you cut off 30 minutes of that Dune, I think it's an outstanding movie as opposed to a good movie. But yeah, so I think my rankings would be Blade Runner 2049, Dune Part 2, Sicario, Arrival, the first Dune. And then we'll throw Prisoners in there just because I haven't seen the rest of them. But let's go on to something that I think Benny will want to talk about, and that is movies that feature rebel fighters. So obviously in Dune Part 2, you have the Fremen against the Harkonnens, against the Empire, basically, the Sardaukar, against all the oppressors. So Benny, kick us off. Favorite movie featuring a rebellion?
Can't say it is my favorite, because, you know, obviously we'd be throwing out some of the original Star Wars there. But I'm going to go with what I think is the quintessential freedom fighter movie from my youth, Red Dawn. So if you are not familiar with Red Dawn, it's...
with Chris Hemsworth, right? No, I'm just kidding.
No. That's the remake. So this one is Patrick Swayze, classic. Charlie Sheen is in there. But anyway, these a Russian subordinate country, they take over the U.S. It's the Cold War's worst nightmare. And a group of intrepid teenagers run a guerrilla war campaign to try to free their family. It's very 80s, but it's one of those things, like, if you grew up and you remember any of the tinges of the Cold War, this was kind of what, as a kid, you feared would happen if the Russians won. And so there's a lot of nostalgia come in, but it's still a fun action movie, even like today. It's cheesy in an 80s way, but it's still a fun action movie.
Right. Very much remember Red Dawn. We watched that movie quite a lot as a kid. The Wolverine's chant, the them witnessing their father being gunned down, and they're all singing America the Beautiful. Like, yeah, I absolutely remember Red Dawn. That's a good one to kick us off. JT, you want to?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I thought you pointed to my bad. All right, yeah, so I will say this. When Benny was going to say an 80s film, I thought, damn it, he picked mine. He picked the perfect rebellion film. And then he said a different film. He said Red Dawn, which is a really fun 80s rebellion film. But to me, it's kind of like Stripes. I like the first half of Red Dawn, and it kind of loses me on the second half. Mm. It's kind of all over the place. It's just not as clean and tight. So it's like to me. I love me some Swayze, though, so I'm never going to, you know, talk bad. But when he said 80s rebellion film, I thought for sure he was going to take my pick. I'm talking about the greatest rebellion in the 80s to this day, a movie that I think has a Criterion Collection coming out soon. I'm talking about the rebellions, the kids from Lambda, 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 Revenge of the Nerds, the greatest rebellion film of the 80s to this day.
No.
We Are the Champions, John Goodman, Ogre, the neighbor from Married with Children. I mean, there's so many great things in this movie. And to see this small rebellion come up and take over and make a new way of life for nerds all over America, I just think it's one of the greatest, you know, rebellion stories ever put on film. And it, I have the Blu-ray. I love that film. I even like part two. I like Nerds in Paradise. I think it's, it gets way too much hate.
Nerds in Paradise is great.
I know, but it didn't do well. A lot of, I feel like it's not even that available on Blu-ray. It's like something you only find on VHS right now. So whoever may, whoever has the rights to Revenge of the Nerds, please put the part two on Blu-ray. I would like to own it next to my Revenge of the Nerds Blu-ray. So yeah, I'm going to say Revenge of the Nerds, the best rebellion film of the 80s.
You just made Benny's night with pulling the Revenge of the Nerds.
I have there, you know, there are a handful of movies that, you know, everyone says, oh, I can quote that whole movie and no one is really being serious, but there are a handful of movies that I think I could get 80 to 90% of the dialogue from start to finish right, you know, if my life depended on it. Then Revenge of the Nerds is most certainly one of them. The showdown at the college fair is one of the great nonviolent battles in the history of cinema.
It's a great movie, man. I love Booger.
I agree, man.
Oh, classic. Dude. Curtis Armstrong is still a gem. I follow him on Twitter, and he still posts some great stuff.
Yeah, and I love part two. He meets, like, his master, like, this Asian guy who lives in, like, a broken-down hotel.
Just, James like, Hong, bodies. Baby.
Yeah, man.
Lopan.
Hey, timely, too. He just got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame this week.
100%, man. Yeah.
So nice. Well, I'm going to throw it out there. Listen, I didn't go as deep into the 80s with Rebellions as you guys did, although there is one of these movies in the 80s that features the Rebel Fighters. Of course, it's the Star Wars franchise. I feel like you just can't use the term rebel without in a movie without instinctively going straight to the Rebellion and versus the Empire. It's iconic. Obviously, like having these Dune movies come out and being very faithful to the Frank Herbert like books, you kind of see where a lot of inspiration from Star Wars is coming from. But this was the first franchise to do it. This is the first franchise that like introduced like the Rebellion. The Rebellion at this point in time has spanned for 40 years, right, in cinema history. And look, I'm gonna name the ones that I think are the best in this franchise. Obviously, my favorite, we've talked about it to death, is Rogue One. That's perfect. I mean, listen, hope is built on, or a rebellion is built on hope, right? That's the tagline for Rogue One. Star Wars A New Hope. Obviously, The Empire Strikes Back is kind of the quintessential Star Wars movie. Return of the Jedi, The Force Awakens. And listen, I loved Solo, and I'll give that some praise. So I think those are my favorite, although Solo really didn't deal too much with the rebellion. I mean, he was kind of helping some rebel fighters towards the end of the movie, but that was really about Solo. But yeah, we're going to go with the Star Wars franchise.
The trial of Solo will happen.
Oh, I hate
that movie.
Oh, do you really? Dude,
so bad.
The Kessel Run, that whole like 25, 30 minute segment of the Kessel Run is some of the funnest Star Wars you will ever experience in your entire life. It's so much fun. Okay, yeah, please. I know I have people on my side. Folks, if you are a fan of Solo, please hit me up at Big Moose Hoss on Twitter. You will be my partner in this battle.
And to the 99% of the rest of the human race, you may join me on my side also.
Sons of bitches.
Betty, what's your take on Solo? Did you have to watch that thing?
I have watched Solo quite a few times. I think it's good. I don't think it's great, but I don't mind watching it. I think it's good.
All right. Well, you guys will team up against me, and where I have so many people to pick up. I don't even know who I'm going to pick, but I'll get somebody.
You'll get nobody. Nobody thinks like you do. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, most people actually, I think, do not like Solo.
What's your name, sir? I'm alone. Alone, eh? Solo. I almost threw up now just reciting that dialogue. Oh my god, that was so bad. People in my theater like start throwing popcorn at the screen. Ugh.
Okay, again, it was the last of the Star Wars movies I mentioned. All right. I still have love for it though. There's still a lot of fun to be had in that movie. I am curious, like I would have liked to have seen the original, because I think it was originally Lord Miller. Well,
it might have been good. Yeah, I think it could have been a good movie if they stayed on and actually did something creative and new.
So it would have been interesting. But Benny, kick us off. What do you got next?
So I'm going with a movie, another comedy that most people wouldn't think of. It's a Robin Williams comedy. Club Paradise.
Club Paradise. I knew.
Paradise. You have Eugene Levy. You have Rick Moranis. You have some of the all-time great 80s background comedy characters. And then you have Robin Williams and reggae legend Jimmy Cliff at the front. And it's just it's a really solid 80s comedy overall. But then at the end, there's an actual revolution on this little island. And it's like the weirdest revolution ever. It only lasts like 3 minutes. But nonetheless, you know, I am a sucker for 80s comedies. And this really, like, if you had John Candy and like Dan Aykroyd in this movie, you would have like everyone from the 80s in this movie. It's like the only two people that were missing. And it's fun and it's heartwarming and it's 80s. And I love that.
Nobody did it better than Robin Williams.
Yeah, love Club Paradise, movie I've watched since I was a kid, so great pick. Then it is weird, though, when that revolution happens at the end, it's like, what's happening right now? Like, why is this in my Robin Williams comedy? I'm going to go with a rebellion film where America is number one, so much so that in order to become a rebellion again, we had to go join somebody else to become a rebellion. But in order to do that, they had to go across the universe. Of course, I'm talking about Kurt Russell's Stargate. America goes across the universe to free a bunch of people who are enslaved with Kurt Russell and James Spader to rise against Ra, a guy who's basically an Egyptian alien god. Roland Emmerich's really first big film. Universal Soldier, I think, was right before this or right after. I can't remember. I think Stargate was after Universal Soldier. But I love this movie. I remember seeing it in theaters as a kid. And James Spader has a great comedic timing in this. But, and then you have Kurt Russell as like a on-the-edge suicidal sergeant who literally they bring a nuke with them. And to me, it's just a really fun adventure film. And it's great to see, you know, these guys joining up with these, like, rebellion of slaves against this alien superpower. It's early Roland Emmerich. He didn't quite have the budget he was going to have, like, movies like Independence Day or, you know, The Day After Tomorrow. But it is a great early sci-fi film. And I'm trying to keep in the – since we're talking about Dune, I'm trying to keep in the sci-fi realm a little bit.
I love Stargate. I do. That might be my favorite Roland Emmerich film.
Wow. Okay.
I very much enjoyed that. That's another one I watched. I saw that one in theaters. I have watched that one 1,000 times. It's funny because I rewatched it probably in the last 6 months. And yeah, the effects don't hold up as great, but some of the like visuals, like with the helmets and stuff like that, still actually do. Like the costumes still work pretty well. The humor works. Yeah, you're right. Spader is on point in that movie. And I've like thought, because I know that there's been a million Stargate TV shows.
Yeah, I've not watched any of them.
I've not watched any of them either. And I after watching that movie, I thought, why are like this could be such a franchise for like
a studio. Why did they do more?
Why was it abandoned? Why did it go straight to TV? Why did it become like an HBO series for a while? Then it became like a sci-fi channel like property. And I was just thinking too. I'm with the effects nowadays, and you could really, really do a good Stargate movie. You could bring back Kurt Russell. You could bring back Spader in these roles. So I did have that you really could redo this movie in a cooler fashion. But alas, I don't think we're gonna get that.
Also, a lot of sand. Very similar to Dune. A lot of sand.
I mean, I'll keep it in the sci-fi genre for my next one, too. I'll go with The Matrix, the original Matrix movie. Now, 2 and 3 have their merits, but the original Matrix movie, I feel like, was just groundbreaking. Like, the bullet time effects that they added to this, the martial arts, like, the CG, some of the stuff doesn't necessarily hold up in this movie, but at the time when this movie came out, it was groundbreaking. The story was groundbreaking. And it really is just the humans versus machines in this movie. It's just that plain and simple thing. The machines at this point in time are basically just feeding off of us. and toying around to keep us alive so that they can continue to feed off of us. So it really is just a good versus evil type of rebellion. And yeah, the humans have been losing for a very, very long time. So it's a true rebellion. Like, we're oppressed. The mankind at this point in time is literally forced to the center of the earth where it's still warm. So I remember just being absolutely blown away. I think The Matrix might have been like one of the first movies I took a date to. And not bad remember movie. Like my date was like, this movie was terrible. And I was like, oh my God, I love this movie so much.
What?
Obviously I didn't marry her, but
dodge that bullet.
Yeah, that relationship did not work out, but what did was my relationship with The Matrix. So I very much enjoyed this movie. Yeah, it is featuring the humans or the rebels.
The Matrix is a great movie, but it's one of the movies that I think the movies that came after it have severely tarnished it. Like, if it had been a one and done, like a Remo Williams situations where, you know, we know there were supposed to be more sequels and they just never happened. Like, I think it would live on as one of the all-time great sci-fi movies. But I really think the three that came after it just really drug it into the dirt, in the back, regardless of how great it was.
Yep, I agree with that.
And so I'm going to go for my final round here, and I'm going to give you guys two to close out my circuit. And they're completely opposite ends of the movie spectrum. One is a movie called Top Secret. Since we were talking about spoofs earlier, this is a Val Kilmer spoof comedy in the vein of Airplane, The Naked Gun. It wasn't quite as big as the other ones, but it was still a really, really solid, like, spoof movie from the golden era of spoof movies. If you've never seen it and you're just having a lousy day, it still holds up. It's still a great spoof movie. And then the other one from the completely opposite end of the spectrum. It was actually a made-for-TV movie in the late 80s or early 90s, and it's just called Sobibor. I believe there's like a remake of this movie in the last few years. But as you guys know, I have a thing for Rutger Hauer movies. I don't care. It's a Rutger Hauer movie. But it's about, it's a concentration camp, Sobibor, and some of the people in the concentration camps, they have an uprising. They are able to kill the guards, and a large number of them are able to escape. And it's a really good, like, World War II drama. Like, you know, if you watch it, like, it'll look a little dated now because, again, you know, the movie's 35, 40 years old now, but it's still a really nice, solid World War II escape drama.
Nice.
What do you got left on your list there, JT?
I'll throw one last honorable mention out there. It is a movie I have not seen in a very long time, but I think maybe is due for a revisit. It is also a sci-fi out there movie and about a rebellion and a kid who is sucked into the whole ordeal because he's really good at video games.
Oh, okay. Yes! I knew somebody was going to say this.
Got to talk about The Last Starfighter, a movie which is such a product of its time, but any kid who grew up playing video games, watched this movie, and was like, yes, this is what I've always wanted to happen to me. I want to take my video game skills and bring it into the real world to fight aliens in a distant planet. So it's a film I have not seen in a long time, though. So it is something I kind of want to give it a rewatch and see if it holds up as well. But it is a beloved film from my childhood that is about a rebellion against the evil alien race.
I'm going to give you guys a stunning admission. Never seen it.
Whoa, no kidding.
Holy crap.
Yep, not seen it.
Wow, okay.
There you go.
I mean, the effects are very, very 80s.
Like, oh, yeah, they're not. It's not Star Wars.
It's not
Star Wars. They don't have that budget, no.
That does not bother me.
Yeah, so it's funny, like, these movies, like, that you keep mentioning, JT, like, I always thought The Last Starfighter could have absolutely been brought back and made into a franchise of sorts. I feel like it would have been a little too closely compared to Star Wars, though.
I'll say this. So apparently Spielberg wanted to do it, and Seth Rogen also wanted to do it. And I actually listened to Seth Rogen's book called Your Book. I listened to the audiobook, and he tells a story about he ran into Spielberg and how they both said they wanted to make a remake of The Last Starfighter, but whoever owns the rights just doesn't want to give it up.
No, like, kidding.
He doesn't want to sell it. And Spielberg went on to make Ready Player One. And Seth Rogen went on to make a TV show called, I'm not sure, it stars Josh Hutcherson. I can't remember the name of it. It was on Amazon Prime, but it's basically his version of a guy who plays video games and fights aliens. So they both went on to make their own versions of it. But Last Starfighter was something they both wanted to make and were never able to get a hold of.
I wonder if that's like a novelization, right? It's like the guy who owns the rights to a novel, like, just refused to give up. I don't, maybe that the last, he didn't enjoy the movie, The Last Starfighter. So he's just refusing to get, I mean, the GOAT himself, Steven Spielberg, is asking you to make this movie, and you're like, ah, I'll pass.
Yeah. Well, I think he was going to produce it. I think DreamWorks wanted to make it. And I think Seth Rogen met with Spielberg, and he's like, what projects are you? And they both were like, we both want to make this movie, but we can't get the rights. And so they just both went and did their own version. But yeah, too bad. I think it'd be a great, it's a great premise, you know? Just don't make anything like Pixels, and we'll be fine.
Oh man, don't tell my brother that. My brother loves Pixel. Oh my gosh,
Pixel is a fun movie.
Oh no.
You got any more in the chamber, JT? All right, I'll finish with my last two, and yeah, these are also I'll keep it in the sci-fi vein. One is the movie Serenity, based on the TV, or with the crew from the TV show Firefly. It's funny because I watched Firefly and I enjoyed it for what it was, but I very much enjoyed this movie Serenity. Obviously you hear the things about like what happened on set with like Joss Whedon, but still the end result pays off. This movie is still fun. It's not quite like they're kind of trying to avoid getting into the fight. And then by the end of the movie, they just charge head on into the fight. And so this movie has always stood out to me. Yes, it is a rebel movie. And then, last, I don't have this one in the category for science fiction, but I've always viewed Inglourious Basterds as a small group of rebels fighting against a large evil oppressor. And I absolutely adore Inglourious Basterds. It's probably in my top 20 favorite movies of all time. So I figured I'd throw those two in. Well, we are going to wrap up, but coming up next, we are going to be doing our Dune Part 2 spoiler review with the amazing Andrew Gordon. Please stay tuned.
Every night, Alex Rogan dreams of going far away.
You really are leaving here, aren't you?
Tonight, he will go further than he ever dreamed.
Welcome to Rylos, my boy.
He's one in a million.
Alert, we are under attack.
But the odds against him are a million to one. Alex Rogan is The Last Starfighter, rated PG. Starts Friday at select theaters. Check newspapers for locations.
Now, the most widely read, talked about, and cherished masterpiece of a generation comes to the screen. Dino De Laurentiis presents Dune.
I see two great houses, few deeds.
We will kill until no Harkonnen breathes Arrakeen air.
I will kill him!
Dune, rated PG-13. Now at select theaters, check newspapers for locations and showtimes.
Welcome back, and here is what you've all been waiting for, the Dune Part 2 review. And joining us today is the amazing Andrew. Andrew, how are you, sir? Thank you for joining us.
I'm doing well. I've never been described as amazing, so I love that introduction. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for being on, Mr. Gordon. And, of course, we're going to lead off with you for your non-spoiler reviews. But before we do, I'll give you a little, you folks a little fact about Dune Part 2. We talked about it earlier. Dune Part 2 kicked off this past weekend with $82 million. $32 million of it was from IMAX screenings alone. This movie was shot 100% with IMAX cameras. This movie is directed by Denis Villeneuve. This is a sequel to the 2021 movie based on the Frank Herbert novel. This movie stars Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Josh Brolin. You know what? If you're listening to this, you probably know who was in the movie. So I'm going to skip that, and I'm just going to pass it right over to you, Mr. Gordon. You tell us your non-spoiler review of Dune Part 2, sir.
Okay, I love this movie. Yeah, there were times where it was definitely a bit of a slow burn, not as much as the first one, but overall, I mean, the first film was a lot of setup, and I feel like I got a lot of payoff with this one. Now, granted, not going too much into spoiler territory here, you know, we know we're going to get another one, obviously, but even if we weren't, I loved everything that I got in this film, from the action to the cinematography, the sound design, the direction from Denis, the acting, the chemistry from the two leads. There was so much in this film. It was such an immersive experience. And, you know, I got to see it with JTE at IMAX headquarters. And I mean, that is just the way it was meant to be seen, in my opinion. I still would have probably enjoyed it if we would have saw it a regular screen, but I mean, this film was made to be seen in IMAX and on the big screen, and is one of the best movie going experiences I've had in a long time. But again, from a story perspective and characters wise, I just love that this film doesn't hold your hand. You know, it's not, you know, feeding you information like you're a 2-year-old, and it's expecting you to pay attention and keep up. And I like films like that where, you know, it doesn't think you're an idiot. And but overall, the characters are just really fleshed out. The action sequences, you know, just Denis Villeneuve, he just really knows how to shoot. Why was it Craig Frazier? Is that the cinematographer? Right.
I believe you probably would know better than I would.
Yeah, but. Yeah. But anyways, the cinematography, because I know he did Dune Part One, or Dune, and he also did the Batman, and that guy just one of the best cinematographers out there. I mean, his wide shots, and even on the close ups for the actors. I mean, just one of the most gorgeously shot films I've seen in a while. Just overall, it's such a fun and invigorating and visceral, immersive movie going experience.
Let's get the negative opinion, non-spoiler opinion out of the way. Benny, yeah. How much did you love Dune Part 2?
Okay, as you know, I am not a Denis Villeneuve fan. He is my kryptonite when it comes to movies. His movies are generally very hard for me to make it through. I'm glad everyone on the earth seems to love him. He doesn't work for me. His movies are always emotionally monotone to the point that I find them uninteresting. That being said, Dune 2 is a good movie. I'm going to admit it. You know, I can't deny that.
Hallelujah.
What?
Yeah. So I'll say this is the first Denis Villeneuve movie that I will say it's a good movie. I enjoyed watching it without like 75 different qualifiers. It's good. Now, I think the cats are saying this is like the best movie in 10 years, the best movie in 5 years. It's one of the all-time great sci-fi movies. I think they're being really aggressive. I think the movie has a lot of flaws, which I can get into in the spoiler thing. But overall, I can't deny it's a good sci-fi movie.
I just want to know, how much did Denis send you in the mail for a check?
Oh, man, he owes me so much. Like, he at least owes me $18.50 for sitting through his other three boring-ass movies.
JT, how about you, buddy? What are you... What's your take on Dune Part 2?
Not spoiler.
I'm always the one that's spoiling.
Yeah, you're the one we always got to tell. Sorry. Listen, this is a movie-going experience, which I think is something that, you know, in the age of streaming, these are the kind of movies that remind you, no matter how good of a sound system, and I have a good sound system, I have a projector, but nothing is going to equal being in a theater with that surround sound, that size of a screen, and a director like Denis who really knows how to use that medium to enhance his film going. You know, I like the Avatar films, but I never felt the same watching them at home as I did when I saw them in the theater. James Cameron needs that big screen, that 3D. And then when you watch it at home, it's like, okay, this is, you know, good, but it's a little paid by numbers. Denis, I feel like, has done this again with Dune too. And I'll watch it at home and I'll still probably, you know, have a good time with it, but it'll never really live up to the watching it in the IMAX theater, which is why movies like this and movies like Avatar are great for cinema, because they're bringing people back to the theater, because they're just not going to get, whereas something like Avengers Endgame, that also needed the big screen, but it was more about the communal experience because everyone has so much invested in those characters and what was happening. Like being in that theater when Endgame and Infinity War came out, it was like a party. It was like everyone, you could feel the energy in the room. Denis' movies don't quite elicit that kind of energy, but I did like this film a lot more than the first film. I said when I walked out of theater, I think I tweeted out, like, I really like this movie and I'm close to loving it. Now, because me and Andrew saw this movie almost 2 weeks ago, I feel like it's not as fresh in my mind, and I definitely want to see it again in IMAX or in a Dolby theater, because I just want to, you know, there are some things that I think I wrestle with, not so much story-wise, but maybe some of the choices he makes with some of the characters and some of the story beats. But even if I have those little, you know, reservations about the film, that doesn't take away from the experience of watching this beautifully made film. It feels like a Lord of the Rings level of filmmaking, but in sci-fi. This is a sci-fi Lord of the Rings for the, you know, this generation or this decade. I don't think it's as good as Lord of the Rings so far, maybe just because I prefer that. I think that's one of the greatest trilogies ever. But he's doing something, and like, to Andrew's point, he's not holding your hand. There are some weird shit going on in this movie. There is some themes, a lot of religious undertones in this movie that are not, you know, easily digested just for, like, you know, like Avatar is very pretty much on the nose with everything. This movie is a little more subtle and at times, you know, hits you over the head with some of its themes. But overall, it's just a very impressive sci-fi blockbuster that we haven't seen in a long time. So, yeah, really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it. I might love it, but I need to see it again.
I dug Dune 2. Man, did I dig this movie. I walked out of the movie theater, and before I even got in my car, whatever, you know. We're, a lot of sand, people. It's coarse. It's rough. It's everywhere. But before I even got in my car, I text JT and Benny, and all I text was, wow. And JT immediately knew, and he was like, impressive movie, right? I was like, that movie was incredibly impressive. It's so beautifully shot. But you come to expect that with Denis Villeneuve movies. There was a lot more character development. I feel like the actors were having more fun in this movie, too. I'll signal out, like, Javier Bardem in this movie as Stilgard, which, when we get into spoilers, I'll just kind of spoil it. Like, he was my favorite actor in the movie. I feel like he was both really serious with how he wanted to play the role, but also was having a really good time playing this role, too. I agree with you guys have all kind of touched on it, and I'll say the same thing. There was not a lot of hand-holding. Dune is a very dense, and there is a lot of lore that goes into this universe. And the first movie felt slow because they had a lot of setup to get to this movie. And I rewatched the original Dune, or excuse me, Denis Villeneuve's 2021 Dune last week before I went and saw Dune 2. And now I have a better appreciation of Dune 1 because of how much they elevated this. The movie just starts off strong and just keeps going. The cast is outstanding. The visual effects in this movie are so utterly impressive. I won't yet say that this is, you know, one of the greatest sci-fi, you know, classics of all time, but I feel like this series, if it continues with the quality that it's doing, the series is going to go down as one of the best sci-fi trilogies, maybe even more than that, because I know that there's a Bene Gesserit series that is potentially going to be coming out, and who knows who else tries to take the reins from Denis Villeneuve after he's done with the third one. But no, I really, really dug this movie. This is probably my second favorite property of Denis Villeneuve's. I really enjoyed Blade Runner 2049. Mm-hmm. But man, this was outstanding. I can't wait to watch this movie again. And this is a movie you need to see in theaters. Mm-hmm. You absolutely need to see it. The soundtrack for this movie was bonkers, but it's funny, 'cause this isn't a soundtrack I would listen to on the treadmill, but it fits so perfect as I'm watching the movie. Like, there were some, like, tracks from the soundtrack that sound like it's from Mad Max. And it's just it but it fits so perfect. Yeah. So yeah. This movie was great. I dug it. I had a great movie going experience. The last 2024 so far has been just a dead zone for movies. And this was the first time I mentioned this earlier, as I was standing in line to get a soda before I walked into the theater. There were people behind me that were like, "Do you think Paul's going to do this?" Like, they were talking about the movie before it even happens. And that hasn't happened since, you know, I went and saw Barbie and Oppenheimer last year. So it really was, like, genuinely, I think people were excited to get back to the movies, and this movie paid out. So I dug it a lot. I didn't spoil too much, but we are going to talk spoilers. So Andrew, kick it off, man. It's open floor. What did you love about this movie? What did you hate? What's your critiques?
Well, a couple of things. First, I understood your, you know, the sand reference you made about Anakin Skywalker. I don't want to overshoot that. Number two, the Mad Max thing, you know, I'd love Junkie XL's score in that. That was great. But it's interesting you said you couldn't imagine yourself listening to the Hans Zimmer score of this in the gym, because I actually listen to this in the gym quite often, not on purpose. Okay, I have this on Pandora with Danny Elfman Radio, so this just randomly comes on. Nice. But having said that, just really quick before I go into spoilers, I don't know about you guys, but since we are talking spoilers now, at, you know, in the final battle there at the end, where they're battling, you know, the Emperor, the Sardaukar, I believe they're called, right?
Yeah,
with the battling, yeah, Sardaukar. I don't know about you guys. You can let me know if you disagree, but it sounded, and it's totally cool. Hans Zimmer's allowed to rip himself off if he wants. It sounded a lot like The Dark Knight Rises. I don't know if you guys felt that. I told JTE that.
Fire rises. I don't know. I'd have to go back and.
Yeah, but I mean,
there's so much going on.
It was 2 weeks ago, but again, that was the everything else in the score was awesome, and I still love the Dark Knight Rises score. But I just remember when I was in the theater and we were hearing that battle, I was like, "Is this the Dark Knight Rises?" Oh. Either way, but in regards to spoilers, there was just so many awesome moments. Where to start? Christopher Walken, right, JTE?
Well, that's funny you say Christopher Walken, because I love Christopher Walken.
I do too.
I never felt like he got a moment where he just rip off a monologue like he does in all his movies. Like, there's certain movies where, like, True Romance or Pulp Fiction or King of New York, there's always that scene where they just give him a nice monologue to really dig his teeth into.
Yeah.
And I feel like he never really got that in this movie, even though I still liked him in it. He never really got that moment. I'm thinking maybe it'll come in part three.
Yeah, no, he didn't have a ton of screen time in this film, but still, I enjoyed what we got from him. I mean, obviously the story revolves around, you know, Paul and Zendaya. So, but I love the you know, the romance in this and the coming of age story, and also I love the drama in their relationship as well. Like, I was actually legitimately rooting for them, and then with what happened at the end, and having an understanding of why. You know, he had to go with Florence Pugh, or had to go that route. I was actually in, you know, Zendaya's character, like having that, like, where do I belong in the world? And that look she gives, that glimmer of, like, you know, how upset she is at Paul. I was like, I really felt for her in that moment. I mean, there's just, you know, it's the character moments. Yeah, the action sequences and the gorgeous shots and the sound design. It's all epic. But it's the character moments is like what the stuff I dug in this movie. It's like everything else was just icing on this beautiful cake for me. But it's the character moments I dug.
I really enjoy the religious undertones and themes of this movie.
Yeah.
With him being the Messiah, him having these visions of, like, the world basically being destroyed and all these people suffering because of him being the Messiah. And this movie shows you his visions don't always come true.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember at the end of the first film, he has a vision of talking to the guy he fights and kills at the end of the first film. He has a vision of that guy actually helping him and teaching him how to be one of the Fremen,
whatever
you want to call him. And so, like, it does show that, like, the choices he makes does change the outcome of what happens. And I think the MVP of this movie might actually be Rebecca Ferguson. I think she's awesome in this movie. I think her side story with, like, trying to steer these people into buying into that he's a Messiah, it kind of has a little bit of a critique on religion. And obviously there's that's going on with the young Fremen and the older Fremen with, like, Javier Bardem and Zendaya. The old people are like, hey, you have to believe in this. He's the Messiah. And the young people being like, no, we don't need to put our faith or our future into some belief. Like, we could do it on our own. To me, that was something, you know, as somebody who has not read the books, has not watched the original film, that is underlying current in this film. I think that was much stronger than the first film. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
So I'm going to do something I never do with Denis Villeneuve. I'm going to start with the positives here. There are a few, like, S-tier level scenes in here, especially during the initial attacks where they're taking out the spice mining equipment, and you can tell that they've actually built, like, a leg of the spice mining machine, and the actors are interacting with it. Like, that is top level sci-fi. Like, the, you know, that's the movie, you know, it's reaching up there with, like, Empire in this one little scene. So the movie has really good highs. And I'll say, I never expected Timothy Chalamet to be able to pull off the character. Like, even in part one, he still has that like boy band vibe. I'm like, okay, nothing he's going to do in these movies is going to make me buy that he's like a guerrilla fighter. And his performance, I bought into him as that character. So I thought his performance was a lot better than in the first movie. And it really made me believe that this character could be doing the things that he did. And also Javier Bardem's performance, I thought was really fun. And so overall, like, you know, I thought there were a lot of really good performances. There are a couple of really special scenes, and it pains me to give him that credit, but there are some really special scenes in the movie. So I will say there are some flaws. I am going to go into the problems that I had with the movie that I think all of humanity is just glossing over because of the excitement of actually having a big, impressive movie in the theater. And so I think people will talk about these in time, but they're not right now. Like, when you guys talk about the movie, like, you know, doesn't hold your hand, I agree with that. But the movie also just randomly throws things out without any preamble or reason for them. And like, if you've not watched a YouTube video about the Dune series or read the books, this stuff is just showing up out of the blue. Like, all of a sudden, okay, there's a talking fetus that can see the future. That's not really built up in anywhere. You don't really know why that's happening. Is there a reason for that to happen? Does that mean anything? It just starts happening, you know? And
because
she drank the worm piss.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, but they never explained it. Okay, the worm piss gave this fetus magic powers. You know, like a line of, that's why this is happening, would have been nice. You know, maybe I'm not creative enough. I should just go with it. But,
well, I'll say, I think when she drinks it, she's the lady who's like one of those, you know, old people.
The Reverend Mother.
Yeah, she basically is like, oh, what have we done? She's with child. Okay. You're not supposed to drink this when you're a child.
Correct.
And it makes the baby like, and that's weird. That's out there. And apparently it's in the book too. But I think that is the cause of it. Does it explain it? It kind of does, but it's out there.
Well, just like a couple other things, like where the first movie is all set up, like sometimes there is just all of a sudden these things are happening and there's not really a description. Like, you know, there's no buildup to the Emperor coming to the spice planet. It's like he reads a letter. Okay, I'm bringing the entire army there. You know, so sometimes the movie is abrupt and going from one thing to the next thing. And like the first movie I felt was like way too long. In this movie, I felt like there should have been some storylines added out so that the ones that were there would be longer, or the movie should have been 4 hours long. So I felt that there were a handful of things that just happened abruptly without like a good buildup. And I will say this, for as impressive as like some of the guerrilla warfare scenes are, and as amazing as the effects are, a lot of the hand-to-hand combat scenes in the movie are just not that great. So like when you get like Josh Brolin's character and Dave Bautista's character, the fight's ridiculous. Like even the climactic knife fight with Timothy Chalamet and Austin Butler, it's very brief. There's not a lot to it. And, you know, they, in the first movie, they spent time trying to build up that these Sudokar are this devastating, awesome force that no one can stand against. They've never killed anyone in the battle. Like just thousands of them die in Horde. They're stormtroopers and that's fine, but they don't even like make a pretense to make them intimidating. They're just, yeah, they're just cannon fodder.
I feel you. I would just say on that Austin Butler and Timothy Chalamet fight, I mean, was it the greatest fight in the world? No, but I like that Hans Zimmer had no music in there. It was a very visceral fight and you felt all the blows. I mean, like the sound design in that fight, like that's what I appreciated about that fight. You know what I mean? And Hans Zimmer, again, going back to Dark Knight Rises, he did the same thing with Batman and Bane. Obviously, I'm not comparing the two fights. I think the Batman versus Bane fight's probably, I mean, you can have your pick your poison and which one you like better there. But my point is, I like that Hans Zimmer, he knows when to tune out the music and let it be more visceral and let you hear the blows. So I just appreciated that it was very visceral and you could hear the blows. And that's why I like that fight personally. But I mean, again, hand-to-hand combat-wise, is it like Ip Man or something like that? Hell no. I mean, I'll go with you there.
And one last thing is, the romance between Timothy Chalamet and Zendaya, Like, I've never seen any of her show, like the shows she is famous for.
Euphoria?
The only thing I've, yeah, the only thing I know Zendaya from is the Spider-Man movies and the Dune movies. That's it. Very limited thing. But she plays all of her romantic scenes like blank-faced and sullen, like in both of these franchises, you know. And at this point, I'm starting to question if she has more than that as a performer, because that seems to be how she is in every single scene.
Yeah, I would say definitely see Euphoria. She shows a lot of range in that series. She's devastating at times. So maybe when it comes to her big blockbuster movies, they're just not giving her the material to really express what she can, especially in Spider-Man. She's throwaway now almost.
And that's what I'm saying. I have a very limited frame of reference.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that. I think the last 10 minutes of the movie shows the most range that Zendaya has in the movie when she has to sit there and watch him go through this fight with Fade Rafa. And then afterwards he wins. She gets to celebrate that victory for only a second before she kind of really sees the Paul Atreides. You know, he turns around, he's like, I'm gonna love you till the day I die. And then boom, he's like, but I'm going to marry this chick and rule the empire. And then just like the brutalization of her having to like deal with that. I thought what was really, really interesting was there was no tears shedded, because in the Furman custom, like, that is just kind of a forbidden thing. And so she's got to just deal with this like brutal heartbreak. And then she turns around and rather than, you know, cry a river, what does she do? She goes and she's like, fuck it, I'm gonna ride a sandworm. Like, I don't know. I think she showed a lot of range at the end. I agree. She can be kind of one note through some parts of the movie. I think when she's fighting, she shows like a huge like range in her ferocity. The scene alone where she was, it was almost mimicking the vision that Timothy Chalamet had in the first Dune. That was amazing. That was awesome. And it just showed the ferocity that like Chani has in her. And then, yes, obviously, like, she's strong, she's capable. At the end, she just kind of realizes, like, she takes that betrayal, she doesn't cry, she turns around and she just lets it kind of fuel that anger. So I do think like she showed a good amount of range in this movie, because I agree with you, Benny, like, up until this point, I haven't seen Euphoria. I haven't seen a lot, you know, a larger sample size outside of the Spider-Man of Zendaya. And she plays that character well, but that character is very distant, cold, quirky, you know, fine. That's easier to play. I don't know. I'm not an actor or actress, so I can't tell you if I did. But no, I enjoyed her in this movie. The knife fight between Timothée Chalamet and Austin Butler, I agree 100% with what you said, Andrew. I think the lack of music, like, it just amped the stakes of this knife fight. And it was great. Like, I don't anticipate these knife fights lasting like longer than a couple of minutes, because eventually someone's going to get stabbed.
It's going to feel repetitive.
Right. So it's not like they're fighting with fists. Like, you're fighting with blades. Like, eventually somebody is going to get stabbed. Somebody is going to die. But I did like Austin Butler was such a threatening presence in this movie.
Exactly.
When they were facing off, I was like, I kind of feel like Fade Rafa would win this like 9 times out of 10, but obviously the dude can see the future. So maybe Paul Atreides, you know, snuck a peek into how to be able to defeat him. So you have to assume that that's always going to be a factor in how you're going to attack Paul Atreides, or Paul Atreides will attack. But yeah, I think that was a great fight. One of my criticisms was they teased it in the promos for the movie, this showdown between Josh Brolin and Dave Bautista. And there wasn't really a showdown. And I was really wanting to see Thanos versus Drax, or Cable versus, you know, Drax. Like, I just wanted to see this, like, this epic fight. And it was like, that's for my king and my friends. Like, it was very simple fight between the two. And I understand that Josh Brolin's Gurney Halleck is one of the greatest soldiers in the Empire, but I always thought that Raban was too. So I kind of wanted a little more payoff out of that fight, but it still was satisfying once Brolin delivered that line.
A funny thing about that is I feel a little similar to the final battle in this movie. I thought, okay, these two armies are going to go at it, and it's not even a fight, really. It is literally Yeah, Shemley just like they use their weapons. Next thing you know, he's in the Emperor's ship. I'm like, whoa, I thought this was gonna be more of an epic battle and less than the ass whooping. You know, if I'm gonna compare it again to Lord of the Rings and Two Towers, when you get to Helm's Deep, you put your heroes through the ringer. You put them to the point where they're about to be decimated, and then Gandalf comes over that hill. You get this like, you know, big soaring moment of like, yes. He's like that first light looking over the hill. And it's a great scene, and it really feels like it puts that battle on the map. And to me, the battle at the end of this, I was maybe kind of, and this is what I was bringing to the movie. I was like, oh, we're gonna get like a Helm's Deep level battle here at the end against the, you know, the Fremen and, you know, the bad guys. Yeah. Instead, it's just like ride those worms on through, drop a couple of nukes, done and done. And I was like, man, I would like a little bit more of a battle, and I would like a little bit more to see our heroes kind of really, you know, go up against it, I guess you would say.
Absolutely. No, those are very fair points, and I totally agree. I would have liked, you know, extended fight scenes on both of those. And I will say this, from the scope of it, the battle, it reminded me a lot of Helm's Deep just on sand. So from that perspective, I was like, holy shit, this is so impressive. I definitely would have liked, even if it was like 5 or 10 more minutes, I would have been, even just from that, I would have been happy. I'm like, okay, I get, you know, he wants to focus more on, you know, Fade Rotha and Paul Atreides. I get it. But I agree. I would have at least like maybe 5 or 10 more minutes of that. And also like the Gurney and Dave Bautista battle. I would have liked a little more epicness in that battle. That was just very abrupt and quickly. If this was the Marvel universe, I would understand why that happened so quickly, but you know, it's not. Right. Having said that, I do want to talk about a twist with you guys. I don't know the book. Don't know shit about the book. That Baron Vladimir Harkonnen twist, I thought really worked for me. I don't know how you guys felt about it. And before we get into it, I can see, because I know the book came out before Star Wars and The Matrix. I'm right to say that, correct?
Correct.
That's so correct, yeah. So having said that, I can see now that the Wachowskis and George Lucas, again, not ripping it off or anything, but just took a lot of inspiration from the book. And, you know, we got awesomeness in The Matrix and Star Wars, you know, whether it's from the Messiah complex of Neo or whether it's the twist of Darth Vader. You know, we got lots of different, you know, certain flavors and aspects from Dune, which is totally cool. I don't mind that. You know, everyone does certain aspects of other things, but I don't know about you guys, but I thought, like I said, I thought that twist worked for me. How did you guys feel about that? About Baron Vladimir Harkonnen being Paul Atreides' grandfather and Lady Jessica's father?
Yeah, Benny, go ahead. So I'm not sure how I feel.
Yeah. So this is what I texted them right after I watched this movie. The movie is the exact same plot of Rise of Skywalker. Huh. I realize this is a much better made movie than Rise of Skywalker, and it's a better movie, but it's the exact same fucking story. We're going here to get this magic thing. Then we're going here to get this magic thing. Then we're going into a cave to get a magic weapon. And by the way, my grandfather is the evil villain who lives on the dark planet. This is just Rise of Skywalker done.
It's executed so much better here, though.
Yeah.
It is, but it's the same fucking story.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, when it happened, here's what I'll say. I think, unfortunately, I need to see part three. Like, they didn't really wrestle with it too much in this movie. It's kind of revealed, but he never really gets to deal with it. And besides having, like, a little, you know, right before he kills him, he's like, hey, Grandpa, bam, I'll kill you. Like, how does that affect the larger scope of the story? I think is yet to be told. And one of the issues I had with the first Dune movie was like, oh, it's incomplete. It felt like a little bit like half a movie. So going in this one, I didn't think that we needed a part three, but at the end of this movie, it feels like we need a part three. Literally, Brolin calls up the ships and is like, don't attack, we'll destroy all the spice. And he comes back and is like, they ain't buying it. They're still going to attack us. So like, there's a huge war about to happen. Like, a lot of things are unresolved. And so now, after I left part one, I was like, I need to see part two to see how I feel about this movie. Well, I definitely like doing part two a lot more. I need to see part three to really get a complete story. And it's like, listen, I knew that with Lord of the Rings. I knew there was going to be three parts for sure, and that each one was going to be a different chapter. But at the end of Fellowship and Two Towers, I felt fully satisfied. Like, yes, I need to see the third one, but I still felt like I was told a complete story with resolutions, even though knowing there was another one coming. This one really feels like it kind of is like, see you next week. But you have to wait, two years. What is?
Yeah, I kind of took that twist in stride, actually, because they're really trying to establish that this, you know, sisterhood, the Bene Gesserit, has been manipulating superstitions, been manipulating faiths, been manipulating bloodlines. So when that's revealed, it's like, okay, well, that was just another Bene Gesserit like manipulation. And I honestly, it made kind of the him killing the Harkin a little more satisfying, or him killing Baron Vladimir. Like, I don't know. It was just satisfying. He just stabs him in the neck. Because obviously this guy is kind of the worst of the worst. But I don't know. I took that in stride. I do feel like that will be expanded a lot more in Dune 3. I feel like that is, and I, like you guys, have never read the books. I have, you know, watched a couple of YouTube videos to try to like catch me up on the first Dune movie. So having seen that happen, I'm like, well, that's just another Bene Gesserit thing. Like, somehow down the line, I'm assuming that they were thinking that they were going to breed, you know, continue to breed this like Atreides and Harkonnen, you know, bloodline together until whatever happens, or this just gives them more leverage because they're very fearful of losing power. And so the Bene, like all of these houses are, I mean, that's kind of the real story behind everything is, you know, the struggle for the loss of power. And the Bene Gesserit are no different than anyone else. They're wanting to continue to control these houses and these empires. And so just doing these crossbreedings and these manipulations within houses just gives them more leverage on just kind of everything as a total. So I was fine with that. What I, since we're talking about the Harkonnens, let's talk about the Getty Prime scene with Fade Rautha in the Gladiator.
That was awesome. Amazing.
Yeah.
So that was so freaking cool.
And I wasn't expecting
it. So cool. No. And I like that. It's like the whole thing was in black and white, but it's not really black and white. Like, there are sometimes when you get close enough that the color actually starts to come through, but it's just the way that everything appears with that black sun and the fireworks look like ink blots that they're launching off. That was easily one of the coolest like alien planet experiences I think I've ever seen on film.
Yeah. Well, it set the tone also for Fade Rautha's character. I mean, you just get that menacing presence from this guy. Also too, it felt like a more serious scene than what we got from Attack of the Clones when they were, you know, you had Padme and Obi-Wan and Anakin in that, you know, the gladiator scene there. But just reminded me of that a little bit visually. But no, again, I love the introduction to Fade Rautha. Like, again, you realize right away this guy is an absolute psychopath. And again, I'm not very familiar with Austin Butler. I just had recently reacted to Elvis, which I thought he was absolutely amazing. So that was completely, I mean, all film, I'm like, when's Elvis going to show up? When's Elvis going to show up? And then I saw him, I was like, holy shit, it doesn't look like Elvis anymore. And then the first scene, I was like, Jesus Christ, this guy is insane. And like, I really liked seeing how versatile he was as an actor. It showed me a lot just from him. And again, like I said, I'm not very familiar with his work, but just from those two films, you see a lot of range from this guy. I mean, I really thought I actually would have liked more of his character, to be honest. Yes. That was something in the film I would have liked was more Fade Rautha personally.
He was brought in so late in the film.
That too, yeah.
It was like an hour and a half into the movie, and then we finally got that Getty Prime scene. And yeah, we've all been kind of teased this ruthless Harkonnen that he's going to have to go up against, but it paid off. I think that scene was easily one of the coolest scenes I've ever seen. But yeah, my one critique is I absolutely would like more Austin Butler and that planet. Just that whole scene worked so well.
Yeah, I thought the visual style was a highlight too, showing that they almost like there's times where they showed them marching and it's like it almost looks like newsreel footage from like World War II. Yeah. It looks like the Nazi regime at times. And I think that's it had to be, you know, done on purpose because it really felt like it. And yeah, the Coliseum scene was great. And I do think Austin Butler was a great bad guy, to the point where I agree with Andrew. I wish he was in a little bit more. Like, I wish he kind of took over the second half of the movie. But Dave Bautista, I think, you know, was kind of playing a similar role to the first one. I didn't think he was like great in this one, but I don't think he was bad. I think it was more about the way the character was written. But it was cool to see that dynamic between him and Austin Butler and Skarsgård. Although Skarsgård does kind of go out like a bitch in this movie, and he is like so evil and menacing in the first, you know, 4.5 hours of this series. Like the way he floats, like the way he is almost killed in the first film, and Oscar Isaac tries to kill him with that poison tooth. He's so menacing, and I just wish his death was a little bit more, not impactful, but maybe a little bit more. I don't know. He just kind of went out like a bitch. Like, well, I don't know.
Look, the dude survived the poisoning. Like, he walked, like, he didn't exactly walk away from it. Like, he obviously, like, has had health issues along the way. But surviving that, like, in a weakened state, that's kind of where he's left at. I mean, that's obviously why he's bringing in, you know, his nephews to be able to run Arrakis, because he is in that weakened state. Like, at one point when he's on Getty Prime during that battle, like, he's almost like in a wheelchair contraption, like almost Professor X, like, watching the, like, whole event happening. So, I mean, yeah, I'm not expecting him to pull out his own knife and, you know, go toe-to-toe with Timothy Chalamet, but I understood, like, him going out the way that he went out, because at this point, he's just a weakened old man.
I think one sequence we need to talk about, which I think might be the most impressive, like, visually action sequence, is the first time he rides the worm. What in the first film, you see it from afar, you know, it's kind of something, but they literally put you, it felt like you're like a really nice, almost like felt like I was on a Disney ride, like a 3D Disney ride. Like, the fact they put you right there, the sand coming up, and I'm like, this is freaking hard. Like, this is something that you could literally die doing. And there's even that great scene where they're like, oh no, this worm is too big. This worm is too big.
Mm.
But then after that, people seem to be riding these things like they're the metro station. There's like little, they got huts on there. They got little blankets down or having lunch. Yeah. And I was
wondering, like, how did they all get on there?
I want to know the logistics. Like, can you stop the worm? All right. Yeah. Here's your stop. Pick it up. Next stop. Arrakis.
Yeah. Timothy's like holding on for dear life. And it feels like he literally could die trying to ride that worm. And then, like, 40 minutes later, people are just riding it, having picnics on there. They got a little tents. And I'm like, whoa. After that experience with Timothy Chalamet, this is like something that is supposed to be super impressive and like death-defying. And yet now they're just taking it like Ubers. So maybe they'll explain that in the next one.
Uber de sandworm.
Now, one thing that I think is, I guess this more of like an overall thought, is if you're going to create an adaptation for a series that's 16 books long, you either need to be inspired by it or you need to do a TV series. So, like, there were random things popped up, like the worm metro station, that I feel that they have not explained up until this point, and then they just happen. And they are not going to have time to explain them. So a lot of these things are going to be left unexplained, why they happened, why they're happening. And I think that's an adaptation problem, that he just needs to edit more of the stuff out of the story.
Well, Denis has said in interviews this past week that he has figured out how they get off the worms and that he can't wait to show it in part 3. Apparently I'm not the only one who's asked these questions. I think it was going on a little viral. I think people were coming out of the movie thinking, how do they get off the worms? And Denis said he has a way they do it and that he's going to show up part 3. So he will at least complete that thought.
I do think that that's such a cool addition to this series, is just their almost control over the worms. Their use of them in the battle was incredible. Cause at that point in time, like, if you're a Harkonnen, you're like, looking at your knife, you're looking at the worm, you're like, ah, fuck. Like, what chance do you stand when you have this, you know, 500-foot worm coming at you.
And speaking of the worms, I thought that was really cool. Just like the world building and learning about Arrakis and the Fremen, I love that they breed them and like see the from babies and all. I was like, that was so fascinating. And I actually felt so sad when like they were collecting the worm piss. I didn't think I'd ever feel so sad for one of the sandworms.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree. I also find that that was super interesting too, that they raised them. Like,
yeah,
it's not these creatures. I'm sure that they're indigenous to the population, but they also be able to find them as youths, and that's part of their culture too, is to extract that water of life from the drowning ones. But well, let's go through our final thoughts, what we really liked about this movie, because it sounds like we all enjoyed this movie a lot. And I think we could sit here, because the lore is so rich in these movies, we could probably sit here for the next 5 hours and discuss what we liked about this movie, questions that we may have. But why don't we get some final thoughts in? Is everyone here at least excited for the next Dune movie?
Oh, I wanted to see it the second the credits were rolling. I was like, I wanted to see Messiah. I think it's going to be called Messiah, right, guys? I wanted to see it the second the credits started rolling. So I'm extremely pumped. Overall, just an extremely impressive feat by Denis, everyone who worked on this film. If you haven't already, I really recommend seeing it in IMAX if you can. Just an incredible time. Action, cinematography, sound design, scored by Hans Zimmer, Craig Frazier. The cinematography was out of this world. And Denis, just in my opinion, did a great job again.
So at this point, I have an okay movie and I have a pretty good movie. So I'm fine seeing a third one. I don't care if they make a third one. But again, that's my own baggage. Like I said, I generally don't like his movies. And it's just a style thing. So even if they make a third one, it's probably not going to be something that I'm over the moon about. But, you know, I'm not dreading it. I went into this one dreading watching it, and I thought it was pretty good. So going into the third one, because of this one, I'm not dreading it. I'm cool watching it. But if they never make a third one, I'm fine.
Wow. Ring endorsement from Benny. I will say this. I really enjoyed this film. I think it's a visual beast. It is a visceral experience at the movie theater. I liked it more than the first film. I think the pacing and the ideas that are being displayed in this film are stronger than the first film. I think the action set pieces are stronger in this film. I think just about in every way, this is a stronger film than the first film. But the first film does set the table. This film, I called it a feast for the senses. Hopefully this third film will be, you know, the dessert and leave us all very satisfied. Because at the end of the day, I do feel like I didn't get a true ending with this film. And I do feel like I will judge this movie once it's complete. Once all three parts are out and I feel like it has a definitive ending, I could really judge this film as a whole, because it really does feel like so far two halves of a movie. And now I just found out we're going to have a third, because this one didn't really have a complete ending. Do some things get resolved? Absolutely. But it also kind of leaves on a cliffhanger. Like, a lot of things are not solved by the end of this movie, especially when it comes to character motivations. The whole Messiah thing with Rebecca Ferguson and the premonition of doom. The fact that there's about to be even bigger intergalactic like war about to happen on this planet. This movie sets up great for the third film, so I cannot wait to see a third film. I think Denis is making his sci-fi Lord of the Rings, and he just has to, you know, if he nails the landing, he's going to have one of all-time great trilogies on his hand, but he has to do it first.
Yeah, I think Denis just showed what a masterclass director he is with this movie. I trust he's going to bring it home for us with Dune 3. I'm excited for a Dune 3. I absolutely, like you said, Andrew, as soon as I walked out of the movie, I was like, yep, I'm ready. Like, I could turn back around and pay another $18 and watch Dune Messiah. So I very much enjoyed this movie. I've enjoyed both of them. JT, you're absolutely right. This is a feast for the senses. Like, this movie just kind of hits on all fronts. It's such an impressive, like, technical feat to be able to put that out. The cast is outstanding in this one. My one criticism is maybe Christopher Walken, but I just feel like he didn't have a lot to do in this one. He just was kind of that, like, Weasley senator that's about to get voted out of office. Which, hey, maybe that was what Denis was asking from him. But otherwise, like, I think we're witnessing some of the new, like, Hollywood Brat Pack with Timothée Chalamet, with Austin Butler, Florence Pugh. We didn't really touch on her, but she was great in the movie. Leia Seydoux is great in this movie. Anya Taylor-Joy obviously had a quick little surprise cameo in that movie as his sister grown. So I feel like she's going to play a part down the line in this. So I am very curious. I wonder if there's going to be a time jump between this movie and the next one. And we'll get to see how much carnage actually occurred or has been occurring so far in this war. But I love the themes of this movie. I love the performances in this movie. I love this movie. It was great so far. It's my number one of 2024. I mean, I understand we don't have a very great sample sizing so far of 2024.
Wait, you're telling me you put this above The Beekeeper?
Okay, you guys know how much I hated that movie. So,
did you?
Oh my god, that movie was so stupid. sorry. Listen to all of you who love The Beekeepers. I love you guys for protecting the hive.
Hey, you know what? It's subjective. I loved it, but it's subjective. I get it. But,
me and Benny enjoyed it also, Andrew. He's the odd man out on this one.
I've been the odd man out so far this year on everything that we've reviewed.
I haven't seen it, but did you like Godzilla Minus One yet?
Oh, loved it. Yeah.
I know I'm reacting to it at some point soon when it's on stream, but I was just curious if this is above that for you.
Godzilla Minus One was in my top five for last year.
Oh, that was last year. Okay.
Yeah. I will say Dune 2024. Like, yeah, I think I may have enjoyed it a little more than Godzilla Minus One.
Okay. Oh, that's disgusting.
I don't know.
That is disgusting.
I'm talking about one that I saw less than a week ago and one that I saw, 4 months ago. So I got to get another sample size of each, take another viewing of it. But yeah, I can unanimously say that I'm very excited for Dune 3. We do want to thank our special guest, Andrew Gordon. The floor is yours. Please. Thank you so much. Please come back. Please join us again for more movie reviews. Anytime, guys.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you for having me on. This was a blast. Appreciate it. And yeah, I'm happy to do this anytime you guys want.
Where can folks find you, sir?
My Instagram and my Twitter, I believe, are AGOR711. And yeah.
Well, amazing. Well, as always, gents, it's a pleasure to be on this podcast with you guys. We finally got a good movie this year. Stay tuned. Next week, we are going to be doing kind of a two-part episode. One part, we're going to be doing a whole Oscars review. We have a buddy of ours, Jacob Blunden, who is my fellow defender of the Batman. Ooh, Andrew, your thoughts on the Batman. Good movie or not?
The Robert Pattinson one?
Yes.
I love the Batman.
There it is, gents. Benny and JT did not. Andrew, you are welcome back every week as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. The ending left a little bit to be desired, but overall, I love that movie. It's especially too. I recently have seen David Fincher's. I'm blanking right now. What's David
Seven?
Fincher's? No. The one Zodiac. That came out. Zodiac. Yeah, and after seeing Zodiac too, I could see a lot of inspiration from Zodiac. But I love the Batman.
Suck on that, JT and Benny.
Beekeeper.
It's hard to make me hate a movie. Just so you guys know.
We will be doing an Oscars review, and we will be doing a brief review of Kung Fu Panda 4. We'll see how that turns out. We've heard some mixed reviews, but tune in next week, folks. As always, thank you for tuning in. Benny, JTE, Andrew, have a good night, everybody.
Land of the Bat is better than Dune 2. Good night, everybody.
See you guys.
Protect Land of Bad is better.
Yes.